Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You are listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Victor Benitez. I'm an interim manager librarian at the labs, and I'm joined by Portia. Hi, Portia.
Hey, how is everybody?
Great. Well, on today's show, DCPL Presents, we have Raven Ruffin here in the studio, and we also are joined by Amanda Figueroa, who's on the phone with us. Raven and Amanda are the creators of the Brown Girls Museum blog. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hey, Raven.
Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Amanda, you're there?
I'm here. Hi, Raven.
Hey.
Well, Amanda, thanks for joining us on the phone, and Raven, thanks for coming out to join us here in the studio. Well, before we talk about your work and the blog, why don't we start out with a little bit about each of you?
Right. So, Raven and Amanda, where are you guys from?
All right. I'm from outside of Chicago.
And
I'm from El Paso, Texas.
Well, I guess I can say that I'm from Chicago. Where outside of Chicago are you?
So in Waukegan.
Okay.
Yeah. But I lived in Chicago when I was younger, but not long enough to claim it, so.
Yeah, I haven't lived in Chicago since 2011.
Okay. Yeah, you know, they're very territorial, so.
Right.
Yeah, so you're from Chicago.
Well, I'm definitely a DC native, so anytime I meet someone from somewhere else, I'm like, oh, that's so cool. Okay, so. What's your favorite place to do in the city? And Amanda, where actually are you now since you're joining us on the phone?
I am calling you guys from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Cool. Okay.
Doing what? Yeah, tropical and exotic in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
And what are you doing there?
So I actually am Boston-based while I complete my PhD in American Studies here at Harvard University.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah. She always saves the Harvard for last.
Okay. So do you guys have any pets or anything, you know, any like little furry creatures in your lives?
Yes, I'm the newest of us to get a pet. I have a pug. He is, well, he's going on 10 months now, but his name is Winslow.
Very cute.
My nephew.
Yes.
And I have a Pomeranian mix named Ari.
Yes.
Oh, that's a cute name. Okay. Well, that's interesting. I think it's like a good little like who you guys are. So how did you guys meet?
Says a lot about us. Yeah,
yeah, it does. It's like dogs say everything.
They do. Oh, but how even do, more if you met
do,
them.
Yeah. How do we meet? So Amanda and I met in grad school. We both went to George Washington University here in D.C., both getting our master's in American Studies with a concentration in museums and material culture.
Okay. I have a question. So when you say American Studies, mm-hmm. what does that mean?
I need an answer.
How is it different to like studying history?
Yeah. I'm going to let the person getting a Ph.D. answer that. Go ahead.
I knew you were going to toss that one to me. So American Studies is, by nature, a very large and very expansive field. Mm-hmm. It's considered to be a cultural studies approach to history or literature or theology or whatever else your object is relating to the Americas. So there are people in American Studies who are doing, you know, of pre-colonial civilizations, mm-hmm. and then there's people like me who my dissertation begins in 1994. So it's huge, and really what unites the field is an interest approach in identifying what is specific to an American transnational identity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Nailed it. How'd I do?
That sounds good.
Yeah.
My advisor is listening.
Literally, our first class in grad school is like, what is American Studies? Like, they ask us and we're asking them and we're all just trying to figure it out together.
So you guys met in while getting your American Studies degree here in DC.
Mm-hmm.
And when did the what do you guys how do you guys consider or see your work now? Would you say your when you describe your work and what you do,
mm-hmm.
how do you describe it?
I mean, I think that depends on like which one of us you're asking. I mean, we meet in the middle in a lot of interesting and cool ways, and sometimes we figure it out and we're like, wow, we've been doing the same thing this whole time. So in grad school, I was looking more at like blackness and representation, and that kind of led me to the digital space, and that led me to thinking about geography and the way that like digital spaces bring us together geographically within the Black diaspora, and her work thinking about Latinx women, and I'll let her explain more, but I think that kind of just led me more into a digital space and the way we work. So with the blog, I handle a lot of that.
Okay.
Yeah, so where Raven is interested in the digital, I'm interested in the analog. My work is about sculpture and installation art by Latina women who are working at the U.S.-Mexico border. So I, too, of course, am deeply invested in geography. And for each of us to be approaching the similar topic, but with these very different objects that take us there, mm-hmm. It's been really interesting to have Raven as my counterpart to bounce ideas off of, to see where the digital and the analog really meet and where they don't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this idea of geography, it's looking at how the specific location around us like impacted the culture, the society, maybe even the language. Is that the things that it looks at, or is there more?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think all of it. I mean, I know specifically for me, I'm really fascinated, right? Like, if I'm thinking about myself within my own body as a Black woman, how I understand my world in a very specific way because of my relationship to my nationality as American versus someone who is Black and in Germany, for instance, right? Like, in some ways, there's a lot that ties us, right, more than not, but then in a lot of ways our understanding is so different and varied just because of geography and our placement on the earth, something that we couldn't control, but I'm also interested in the way that we do control that in like the digital landscape.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think to kind of build on that, we're definitely interested in how geography is impacting culture, but also the way that culture is impacting geography. El Paso, Texas is a border city, and you wouldn't know it to look at the city. El Paso and Juarez are one city that's separated by a political line. So to say that this relationship between geography and culture goes in one direction is a pretty common misconception, and one that I think we're both really invested in kind of dismantling.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, we've seen in countless of immigrant histories, mm-hmm. people moving somewhere and their culture very much preserving no matter what the geography is.
Right.
People who didn't move anywhere, the thousands and thousands and thousands of people who get to say, no, the border crossed me.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The culture changed. My geography did not.
Right, and that all carries a narrative, so that's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you each get into this work?
together.
Do you mean before we met or like after?
Cause well, yeah, before you met, leading up to it. And
oh, yeah. Before meeting Amanda, was there a time before you? Like I said, grew up outside of Chicago, didn't really have exposure to like museums. Was a library fiend, though, a large reader, but didn't tie all of that together like in a larger cultural landscape until much later. And so it wouldn't be until college, really, while I was in Richmond, Virginia, and I was doing a degree in anthropology, and I got really interested in museums because I was being pushed in this scientific lane. But I realized I had a fascination with the cultural side of things and the linguistic side of things. And so I started interning, and yeah, I just went down this path of like interning and volunteering at the museums, all of the museums in Richmond. And then I finished all of my electives, and I just kind of had like time. So I started taking all of these Black feminist courses right before I graduated, and it just all started to just merge together. I was like, oh, like, I can take this anthropological work that I'm doing and thinking about these larger frameworks of, you know, culture and representation, and like tie that to this feminist lens. And it was while working at the museum, the Black History Museum in Richmond, that I was seeing the museum as this space, this really untapped space for community, for urban sustainability, and the ways that they could be preserving Richmond's history, using untapped space. I shouldn't say untapped, because it's all been used in some form or another, but using spaces that are underutilized for the purpose of the community. And so I got really fascinated, and so that kind of like launched me into this path. And so I applied to grad school and got it.
That's great. How about you, Amanda? What led you into this work?
Sure. Well, for me, like I said, I grew up in this border city, a predominantly Latino city, and then went away to college in Stanton, Virginia, a very small town, where I was one of the only Latina students on campus, one of the only Latinas that I certainly knew in my immediate community there. And I remember it was the first time that I kind of realized, oh no, like, Latinidad is something different. We're not the same. It's the first time I realized that my cultural experience not only was not universal, but was so foreign to so many people. And because I'm a deeply outspoken and bulldogish young woman, it was a job I took on myself to raise my hand in classes and say, no, wait a second, we're out here, you need to know about me too. And so after I, you know, completed my degree and I was looking for kind of my next opportunities, that was my mission, was this kind of public education of making Latinx experiences and culture and knowledge and art primarily as visible and as important kind of as possible. And so I also applied to graduate school and kept going.
That's great. Like, I definitely want to highlight something that you said about how your culture was almost foreign, just depending on, like, where you were in the United States. Like, you were in Virginia, which is relatively close to an urban environment, but you were just the only Latina that you knew of on that campus. And I think that's an interesting experience, because when I went to college, I wanted to go to HBCU, and I was like, you know, I want to try different experience, meet, you know, all different types of people, and it definitely... the campus I was on was 90% Caucasian. Wow. And it was we were in the minority and in the extreme minority, because the town surrounding was also, there was no population, there was no African American or Hispanic population at all. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting. So I just wanted to highlight what you said. I was like, oh yeah, like, I can definitely relate to the experience of just going to college and having a new world presented to you in a way, and you being new to somebody else.
Right.
Yeah. It was wild. My my first day there, I was like moving into my freshman dorm, and it was a very small college. So one of the administrators, he's, you know, walking around and like greeting the freshman class, greeting the young woman, and she came into my room and she said, "Amanda, I'm so happy to meet. I'm so excited to meet you." And I was like, "Are you my mom?" I'm very confused. I'm 17. And she was like, "Well, I'm so excited to meet you because I wanted to share this fun fact with you." She said, "I looked it up, and that you were the 42nd Hispanic student to ever attend this college." And I was like, "Oh, wow, okay." And that was kind of the tone there on out. People were really, really noticed my difference.
Yeah, put it nicely.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah. I mean, they noticed that they were pointing it out to you.
Right. Yeah, it was funny that way. Yeah, people love to let me know.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about museums. How do you explain to someone what a museum is? Like, you said you grew up with having been to museums in Chicago. Mm-hmm. What were some of your favorite experiences, or why did you enjoy going to those mm-hmm, places?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. That's kind of how the blog started, trying to explain museums to people and mostly our families. So I didn't really go to the museums growing up. And so my strongest memory of a museum is that in eighth grade, we had a Chicago trip. Cause like I said, before we started airing, I'm from outside of Chicago, so about an hour away. But, we had a Chicago trip, and, really, it was about, like, hanging out with the boys and, like, hanging out with everybody else. And so it wasn't really like, oh, we're going to go to the museum. It was just like, yay, we get to not be in school and get on the bus and, like, you know, be kids. But what happened is we went to the DuSable, which is the African-American Museum in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I just remember it being, like, so big to me. Like, I don't know why my memory, and I've been in recent years, and I'm like, why was this place, like, like, how big was I that this place felt like a 3-5-story mansion or something? Right. But it just felt so massive to me. And I just remember there was an exhibition on Madam C.J. Walker, and the way that they exhibited, and I don't remember much, but they had, because Madam C.J. Walker made her money through hair care, black hair care. And so there was this braid that was, like, trailing the floor, like, through the exhibition space. And I don't know why, but that just, well, probably like just my fascination with black hair and just seeing something like that, like representation matters. So not knowing that something like that could go into a museum. And so I just remember that sticking to my mind. Oddly enough, though, wasn't something that, like, you know, from there I was like, I'm going to work in a museum, because I think at that point, which again, why representation matters, I didn't know what the jobs were. Right. So I had nothing, you know, I had nothing to, like, really hang my hat on. I just knew there was this space and it was really cool. And we had also went to the museum, the Mexican museum there too. And so, like, that was really cool. But again, I didn't know who was putting these things together or how any of that worked. And so up until that, I just kind of, like, encapsulated that moment and really loved it, but then kind of left it there. And so, like I said, it wasn't until college where then I'm like, oh, wow, like, that memory, which is still with me, like, I get what that experience did and, like, how that has the power if we, like, really harness that. Can really be influential, you know, in teaching people about their own history, their own culture, and things of that nature. So that was something I had to, like, teach myself. And then, I mean, it was already hard enough. I went and majored in anthropology. So my family was like, what is that? Like, didn't we figure everything out? And I'm like, no, there's so much more to learn. So then explaining that getting a master's in museums and material culture, like, you know, there's more than being, like, the frontline person, the visitors services person, which I've also done in my past lives. But yeah, just really educating myself and my family on, like, all the different parts that go into museum to help it run. And that, you know, everything that's on a wall, like, someone was purposeful in bringing that together. So I do have an exciting memory of, like, a couple of years ago, I took my mom to the Chicago Institute of Art. Mm-hmm. And that was a really tearful moment in which I took her through the museum, and we made it to the African art section. And she said, I get what you do now. And she was like, this is all they have of us. Like, this is all they know about us. And so that was a really touching moment where, one, my mom understood what I do, but she really could understand, like, the power of museums to, like, mm-hmm. create these narratives. And so that was really awesome, along with her touching everything and the security hating us and following us around. So that was a fun day.
How about you, Amanda? Did you have any sort of standout experience or lack of experiences with museums as you were growing up?
I certainly have had many emotional experiences in museums of all kinds. But I think for me, the reason why I do this work is because I spent so much of my life kind of receiving these messages about latinidad, about who I am, who I should be, that I didn't know where they were coming from. Some of them seemed accurate, some of them seemed wrong and crazy. And for me, I kind of moved through especially my undergrad, but my college years, trying to figure out, where does this come from? How does this happen? How did we get here? And eventually, I also came to the realization, well, museums are warehouses of knowledge production. That's where people learn a lot, mm-hmm. especially people who don't or no longer have access to, you know, higher education, other other like messaging. They go to museums, they learn things. What museums put on the walls is significant. What museums don't put on the walls is perhaps even more significant.
Right.
And so for me, that was the impulse where I was like, well, if I want to be the person in charge of this messaging, if I want to be the person who decides it's time to get a degree in museum studies, it's time to infiltrate a little bit, is how I always thought about it. I think to give you one of my own significant museum experiences, in El Paso there exists the Border Patrol Museum. What they like to say about themselves is that they are the world's only Border Patrol Museum, to which I say, yes, give me 10 years. But it's a museum that is, that has a very specific perspective on the U.S.-Mexico border, and it's a perspective that's informed deeply by not just the Border Patrol agents, but the Border Patrol agenda. I've been into that museum. I've been into that museum with my mother, who has always grown up at the border, who's lived a whole life at the border. And to move through that space as a person who has lived there, who knows this geography, and to see the messaging that I'm being given back is so, it's radically different. And so that for me, every time I go home, I try to go to the Border Patrol Museum and feel my feelings. And remember, you know, the things people put on the walls, the things people say in museum labels become real.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember talking to you about that, the museum, a few years ago. Can you tell them some of like the objects that were in there? Because I remember that being like really jarring.
Yeah. It's such an interesting space. Some of the things, I'll tell you about the labels, right? The labels. To be a person in the U.S. Border Patrol Museum, you have to be an agent, a Border Patrol agent.
Mm.
Otherwise, you can be a smuggler, or you can be an alien, or you are not mentioned at all. And
so
that alone...
There's three characters in the museum. Agent,
yes.
Smuggler, and
alien.
Yes. And according to this museum, those are the only people who exist at the border.
Mm. Mm.
Right.
I am none of those things. Mm-hmm. A lot of people I know are none of those things.
Right. Yeah. No,
and so...
I mean, someone purposefully went and created those categories.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, they gave a narrative that's not true.
Or that's true to the narrative that they're trying to put out there.
Yeah, right. For an academic, I am perhaps less interested in an empiric truth than some of my colleagues. I like to say I'm interested in truth in advertising. It doesn't matter to me what these people think is true. What matters to me is what people do with it.
Yep.
Right.
It is alarming. That's kind of sad to think about. What do we see in our own museums now that's not necessarily mm-hmm. the truth and how mm-hmm. we're being misled? When I was younger and I read, you know, when you're younger and you kind of go through the history lessons, you're like, okay, well, this is how this happened, right. This is how this happened. And you're just like, oh, okay, I'm accepted as a truth.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of get older and you dive more into it and it's like, oh, like this is, I'm like Lincoln and slavery.
Right.
I think that's one of the most amazing things that people are so happy about Lincoln. And mm-hmm. I'm just like, okay, but do you know why he mm-hmm. did this? So I can definitely say like that's important work for just trying to find the truth and be more truthful and kind of represent the truth, whether it's a hurtful truth,
right.
Just so we can kind of acknowledge what has happened and things that still impact us today and why we are still so divided as a nation. Yeah, that was very powerful. Thank you for sharing that.
Raven, Amanda, how do you guys think that museums have changed, or are they changing? What do you hope to see in museums in the coming up years? Or what's the next shift for museums?
Yeah. I mean, museum, like a lot of places, like they're always in this shift. You know, you can go back on like every conference title. It's always like a shift, mining, shifting, diversity, like all those buzzwords. You know, have a renaissance right now. We just passed the like diversity renaissance. Now we're in the like shifting the landscape renaissance. And so I'm hoping that this shift will be a sustainable one, especially I think the digital space has really kind of cracked museums open a little bit more in a way that they not only have to confront themselves in the ways that they constantly have had to in the last few years, but they have to actually like follow through because we're watching them in a way that we couldn't before, or I shouldn't say that we couldn't, but that we're communicating about us watching them more than we were in the past. So I think what's happening right now is that we're seeing a lot more more activists and more people outside of the museum space who are sustaining their own movements and saying, you know, we actually don't need the museum to do this collective work. And so, I mean, we could be an example of that with Brown Girls Museum Blog, but there's so many more who are, you know, doing this work outside of museums, and then museums now are looking at them and saying, bringing them in as examples of where they need to be and how they're collecting, how they're bringing communities into museums. So that's kind of the space that I'm seeing museums in right now.
I agree with you completely, as per usual. I agree with you completely. I was going to say that I see museums becoming less arbiters of knowledge and more community centered.
Yes.
Less collections, more community. Mm-hmm. I think is my soundbite take. I'm excited to see more museums opening their doors at the bare minimum and finding out how people around them want to use that space.
Right.
If not, you know, opening the doors and then pursuing the community members themselves, leaving the museum to go invite people in.
That's really interesting because it really is parallels the work of what libraries are trying to do. We see ourselves more as also community spaces,
right,
where people can come both to the library, but the library comes out to the community,
right,
and engages the community in information, knowledge, and all those things.
And one of the last few free places people can go to.
Right, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, we recently collaborated, well, I should say Portia collaborated,
yay,
with both you and Amanda on an event in October. The event was called Preservation, Care, Librarianship, Keeping Local Memory Alive. What can you tell us about how that all came about?
Yeah, sure. October feels like so long ago, but it never happened. Portia was amazing. So we partnered with DCPL, worked very closely with Portia at the Fab Lab in NoMA to put on a panel, a small music concert, we used the shipping containers, and I'll let Portia talk more about that with some of the activities that DCPL provided, but it was really amazing, and we just wanted to cultivate an environment that was free and open to the community. So I love the Fab Lab being that it's outside and open and people could walk past on their, you know, whatever daily errands and kind of just drop in, which they definitely did. And then we hosted a panel of amazing women of color. So Allison Bechet, Desiree Van Frederick. Who else? Sorry, there's someone nodding, so I'm like laughing. Yes, we invited the right people. Nicole Ivey, who is a scholar at GW. Ducina Albro, who's an artist here from the Dominican Republic. And the last person, Marion James Daly, thank you, from DCPL. And so all of them were just so amazing. And the audience was wonderful as well with their questions. And so it was just a really great environment talking about the future of libraries,
right,
talking about women of color as preservationist in our communities. And with that collective of people, I really wanted to get at the way that we're all memory keepers, and doing it in very unique but collective ways. So with Desiree Van Frederick, thinking about the way that she's a collector with her store that she once owned, a boutique Nomad Yard, but continues to do that work as a collector of like the city's history and art. Allison Bechet, she creates really awesome collectives and pop-ups. So she had the Resource Library at the time when we invited her at Union Market. And then Dusina, her artwork is informed by DCPL, so she brought with her the books that she got from the library as part of an installation that she used to inform that work. So it was just really, really cool seeing the way that the library is a part of all of our lives, whether we use it to inform our work, use it to do our work, or are doing that work of like keeping history. And then also DCPL provided some really great workshops for people on site too.
Yeah, no, it was a fun day.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know how we met was through a mutual friend, Diamond.
Yes. Thanks. Shout out to Diamond.
Yes, Diamond, who's also works for DCPL. And she came up to me. She's like, Portia, there's this cool idea. I need you to look at it. I need you guys to have this. And I was like, okay. And then once I met you, and it just went so well, and it just gelled perfectly.
Yeah.
And you too, Amanda, like everything just kind of, I know I met you the day of the event. But it was really well done.
Thank you. It was great.
It was informative. I think you had a great crowd. Everything that kind of played out was more. And the thing I think we have to kind of move towards is something that's interactive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an interactive event. And I think that's something where libraries kind of struggled with before, kind of having things where we want people just come to us, but
right.
we didn't really offer something where they can kind of like touch or feel or like enjoy or like kind of have, because in libraries, you can't be loud.
Right.
And this was an outdoor event at the Fab Lab in NoMA, and we were able to listen, have a DJ.
Yeah,
and
we couldn't have been louder.
Yeah. So it kind of had the feel of a party, but you were also around people that wanted to share with you and share knowledge and kind of want to pass down knowledge and also give you information. And I think that's a powerful thing, especially in a community that has been robbed of like having opportunities.
Yeah.
So I thought it was I was so happy. I thought it was a great event, and I would love to do it again.
We're down. Yeah. So part of that noise was Honore. So she works at the Hirshhorn, but she runs the art lab. So she brought her youth.
Right.
So they did some of their original music.
Mm-hmm.
And then she also does the Hand Games project. So we had like remixes to Miss Mary Mack going, and people were making beats. And then we also had a local art publication and collective, Dirt DMV, was there doing some like live archiving. So it was really dope. And yeah, you guys had the Facebook archiving.
And we had the 3D demo.
Yes. So it was really awesome. Yeah, it was a really cool vibe.
No, I mean, I enjoyed it because it kind of takes these practices that you often see people in museums doing or like artists and bringing them out into the public and adding more value into it by having everyone engaged in it.
Yeah.
And also we're taking things like rapping and a cultural thing and linking it to this historical movement of oral histories in like a really powerful way.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the point is that we all engage in this work in some way, whether we do it professionally or as a hobbyist or, you know, sometimes we're just doing it. We don't even realize that like our own Facebook, you know, is an archive of sorts and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk to us more about the blog. What other activities or things have you guys been doing since this event?
Oh, I'll let Amanda take over.
What have we been doing since the event? So many things.
Yeah.
We've been planning and working very hard on of our more organized public programming community incubator project called Brown Art Inc. Please go follow us on the Instagram. and gearing up for our new season of programming, the Preservation Care Librarian Event, with our 2018-2019 programming theme of citation and memory. And so we're so excited. Like, if you're going to call your theme citation, you have to get the local library support.
Right.
You have to. So looking forward, we're going to continue that season in spring with Brown Art Inc. We're going to be for 2019-2020 will be. We have some more long-term partnerships coming up that are still kind of about this that was interested in geography in communities of color and their histories, and also can you have our some jobs and
yes.
That's great. What do you guys each do for the blog? I know you guys have different sort of roles within the blog.
Yeah.
Do we?
We meet in the middle. I mean, the great thing is there's two of us, like, so we don't have to fight about too many things. But we also try not to be like nitpicky about like, that's my thing, that's your thing. We just kind of naturally let it kind of flow. So I'm more like big picture planning kind of thing. So I see the idea, I see like the vision, the color, who we need to work with, like all of that. And then, like I said, my background is in digital, so I handle our social media platforms. That's Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Coming soon on YouTube. And so I handle more of that and kind of thinking through like our relationships, especially since I'm here in DC, like our relationships to the artists and the creatives, and like building those partnerships. Mm-hmm. And then Amanda is our technical maven. So she can like take everything I say and be like, here's how to build it. Here's how to actually make that work. Actually, Raven, that's not possible. So please stop, you know, those kind of things.
What's your approach when linking people together or trying to build this network? What's your approach in just going out and talking to them and getting them involved?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing is just like meeting people where they are, right? So neither one of us, like we said, are natives to DC. And a big misconception when people come here is like, there's no art here, there's no this, there's no that, it's so political. And you know, I was one of those a-holes for a minute, especially being in grad school. Where else was I gonna go but to class and back home? And the GW campus leaves a lot to be desired. And so I wasn't seeing much around me, and so it was really about, you know, going to the spaces. And so early on, actually, it was Nomad Yard was a welcoming space for that, and Transformer, Hamiltonian. There's just a lot of dope spaces around DC where I was learning that, you know, artists and creatives were collecting. And sadly, a big part of my connection, like I said, with Nomad Yard was fighting for the space to stay. Mm-hmm. And so being a part of like the motions and like going to the courtroom was gut-wrenching, but it also led me to see the mass amount of support around artists that was available and how they were uplifting each other. And so that was a big part of meeting a lot of people. And then from there, you know, Just learning and attending people's shows, DC Arts Center, and so just kind of slowly piecing things together. And we were doing a lot of writing when we first started, and so that was a big piece too. So we were going to different places to do reviews and do interviews and things like that. And so that really kept us connected to people early on, and I'm grateful for that, so that we could like really sustain some relationships now that we're getting more into the programming side of things.
Mm-hmm. So where exactly do you see?
Oh, did you want to add something, Amanda? Sorry.
I was just going to add that I think ever since day one, maybe even implicitly, our philosophy has always been approaching people to see what they need. Mm-hmm. You know, ask, beginning every partnership with the question, what do you need and how can we get it for you? Mm-hmm. And that has meant a lot for me, both professionally and, you know, personally, ethically.
Right.
So I have a question. Where do you guys see Brown Girls Museum blog in the future in, like, the next 5 years?
That's a great question. So as Amanda mentioned, we recently just launched the business side of things, Brown Art Inc. So that's our community incubator to support the DC arts art ecosystem here, and hopefully extending into like Baltimore as well. So that's where we're going. That's where we are. So we're launching the site for that soon. The programming has kind of been up until now a pilot for that, to really just kind of like test what kind of programming our community is interested in, what kind of programming they want, and things of that nature. And so really just trying to really create a space, an intentional space, for people to really connect to local artists and connect local artists to the community. So thinking about different partnerships that can help do that, in the community or in the city, I should say, and then thinking about, you know, again, how do we lift those resources that are already available to us, and really just, you know, make them visible and just help them to propel forward. Yeah. Did you want to add something, Amanda?
All of that was perfect. The only thing I would add is, for me, this business is coming back to D.C., degree yes. in hand.
Surviving.
Lord, please let it not take me 5 years.
We're all praying for her safe return, yes.
All praying for this dissertation completion.
Yeah. Well, best of luck with that.
That's all we got, girl.
We're getting close to the end. This has been really fun. Is there anything you want to say before we close? Any, do you ever see having an actual like space for the blog? That's, like physical space?
Yeah, that's something that we've tossed around a lot. I think right now we're holding off, you know, you guys got spaces. We're here now. Right. So we'll just use other people's space for right now. yeah, that would be wonderful to have a space eventually to like be able to support artists and creatives, whether that looks like studio space or, you know, video space, like whatever people just need. And if they can let us know, we'd have it available to them. That's like the dream, the goal, right now. But right now, yeah, just really trying to strengthen the programming in the city so that people really recognize how vibrant the art scene here is.
It is, yeah. And you guys have definitely have a partner in us, the labs.
Yay.
So please reach out whenever you guys
sounds
need
like
space
that too is coming soon.
Or a yeah. partner. But Amanda, thanks for being on the phone with us, and Raven, thank you for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you both.
Yeah. This was awesome. You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcast live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Listen and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast, and visit the library at dclibrary.org, or on Instagram at dclibrary, and on Twitter at DCPL. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.